Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlenka again. I'm going to continue with the writings of Sri Aurobindo from his book, Essays, Divine and Human. And today we'll have the first half of the essay called Social Reform. Reform is not an excellent thing in itself, as many Europeanized intellects may imagine. Neither is it always safe and good to stand unmoved in the ancient paths, as the Orthodox obstinately believe. Reform is sometimes the first step to the abyss, but immobility is the most perfect way to stagnate and putrefy. Neither is moderation always the wisest counsel, and the mean is not always golden. It is often an euphemism for purblindness, for a tepid indifference, or for a cowardly inefficiency. Men call themselves moderates, conservatives, or extremists, and manage their conduct and opinions in accordance with a formula. We like to think by systems and parties and forget the truth is the only standard. Systems are merely convenient cases for keeping arranged knowledge. Parties a useful machinery for combined action, but we make of them an excuse for avoiding the trouble of thought. One is astonished at the position of the Orthodox. They labor to deify everything that exists. Hindu society has certain arrangements and habits which are merely customary. There is no proof that they existed in ancient times, nor any reason why they should last into the future. It has other arrangements and habits for which textual authority can be quoted, but it is oftener the texts of the modern Smritikarans than of Parsivara and Manu. Our authority for them goes back to the last 500 years. I do not understand the logic which argues that because a thing has lasted for 500 years, it must be perpetuated through the eons. Neither antiquity nor modernity can be the test of truth or the test of usefulness. All the rishis do not belong to the past. The avatars still come. Revelation still continues. Some claim that we must at any rate adhere to Manu and the Puranas, whether because they are sacred or because they are national. Well, but if they are sacred, you must keep to the whole and not cherish isolated texts while disregarding the body of your authority. You cannot pick and choose. You cannot say, this is sacred and I will keep to it. That is less sacred and I will leave it alone. When you so treat your sacred authority, you are proving that to you it has no sacredness. You are juggling with truth. For you are pretending to consult Manu when you are really consulting your own opinions, preferences, or interests. To recreate Manu entire in modern society is to ask Ganges to flow back to the Himalayas. Manu is no doubt national, but so is the animal sacrifice and the burnt offering. Because a thing is national of the past, it need not follow that it must be natural, national, to the future. It is stupid not to recognize altered conditions. We have similar apologies for the unintelligent preservation of mere customs. But various as are the lines of defense, I do not know any that is imperiously conclusive. Custom is decorum, that which is all well-bred and respectable people observe it. But so were the customs of the far past that have been discontinued and, if now revived, would be severely discountenanced and in many cases penalized. So too are the customs of the future that are now being resisted or discouraged. Even, I'm prepared to believe, the future, no less than the past, prepares for us new modes of living which, in the present, would not escape the censure of the law. The achar that makes the shishta, not the shishta who makes the achar. The achar is made by the rebel, the innovator, the man who is regarded in his own time as eccentric, disreputable or unmoral, as was Sri Krishna by the Bodhisattva, because he upset the old ways and the old standards. Custom may be better defended as ancestral and therefore cherishable. But if our ancestors had persistently held that view, our so cherished customs would never have come into being. Or, more rationally, custom must be preserved because its long utility in the great past argues a sovereign virtue for the preservation of society. But to all things, there is a date and a limit. All long-continued customs have been sovereignly useful in their time. Even totemism and polyandry. We mustn't ignore the usefulness of the past, but we seek in preference a present and a future utility. Custom and law may then be altered. For each age, its shastra. But we cannot argue straight off that it must be altered, or even if alteration is necessary, that it must be altered in a given direction. One is repelled by the ignorant enthusiasm of social reformers. Their minds are usually a strange jumble of ill-digested European notions. Very few of them know anything about Europe, and even those who have visited it know it badly. But they will not allow things or ideas contrary to European notions to be anything but superstitious, barbarous, harmful, benighted. They will not suffer what is praised and practiced in Europe to be anything but rational and enlightened. They are more appreciative than Occidentals themselves of the strength, knowledge, and enjoyment of Europe. They are blinder than the blindest and most self-sufficient. They are charmed by the fair front Europe presents to herself and the world. They are unwilling to discern any disease in the entrails, any foulness in the rear. For the Europeans are as careful to conceal their social as their physical bodies and shrink with more horror from nakedness and indecorum than from the reality of evil. If they see the latter in themselves, they avert their eyes, crying, "It is nothing," or "It is little. We are healthy, we are perfect, we are immortal." But the face and hands cannot always be covered, and we see blotches. The social reformer repeats certain stock arguments like shibboleths. For these antiquities, he is a fanatic, or a crusader. Usually, he does not act up to his ideas, but in all sincerity, he loves them and fights for them. He pursues his nostrums as panaceas. It would be infidelity to question or examine their efficacy. His European doctors have told him that early marriage injures the physique of a nation, and that to him is the gospel. It is not convenient to remember that physical deterioration is a modern phenomenon in India, and that our grandparents were strong, vigorous, and beautiful. He hastens to abolish the already disappearing Notch girl, but it does not seem to concern him that the prostitute multiplies. Possibly, some may think it is again that the European form of the malady is replacing the Indian. He tends towards shattering our cooperative national system of society and does not see that Europe is striding titanically towards socialism. Orthodox and reformer alike lose themselves in details. But it is a principle. It is indeed principles that determine details. Almost every point that the social reformers raise could be settled one way or the other without affecting the permanent good of society. It is pitiful to see men laboring the point of marriage between subcastes and triumphing over an isolated instance. Whether the spirit as well as the body of caste should remain is the modern question. Let Hindus remember that caste as it stands is merely jat, the trade guild sanctified but no longer working. It is not the eternal religion. It is not Chaturvayantya. I do not care whether widows marry or remain single, but it is of infinite importance to consider how women shall be legally and socially related to man, as his inferior, his equal, or superior. For even the relation of superiority is no more impossible in the future than it was in the far distant past. And the most important question of all is whether society shall be competitive or cooperative, individualistic or communistic. That we should talk so little about these things and be stormy over insignificant details shows painfully the impoverishment of the average Indian intellect. If these greater things are decided, as they must be, the smaller will arrange themselves. There are standards that are universal, and there are standards that are particular. At the present moment, all societies are in need of reform. The Parsi, Mohammedan, Christian, not a whit less than the Hindu, which alone seems to feel the need of radical reformation. In the changes of the future, the Hindu society must take the lead towards the establishment of a new universal standard. Yet, being Hindus, we must seek it through that which is particular to ourselves. We have one standard that is at once universal and particular, the eternal religion, which is the basis, permanent and always inherent in India, of the shifting, mutable, and multiform thing we call Hinduism. Sticking fast where you're like a limpet is not the Dharma. Neither is leaping without looking the Dharma. The eternal religion is to realize God in our inner life and our outer existence, in society not less than in the individual. Isha Dharma Sanatana. God is not antiquity nor novelty. He is not the Manava Dharmashastra. He is not Vijaranya nor Raghuanandan. Neither is he an European. God, who is essentially Satchidananda, is in manifestation Satyam, Prema, Shakti, truth, strength, and love. Whatever is consistent with the truth and principle of things, whatever increases love among men, whatever makes for the strength of the individual, the nation, and the race, is in fact divine. It is the law of Vaivasvata Manu. It is the Sanatana Dharma and the Hindu Shastra. Only God is the triple harmony. He is not one-sided. Our love must not make us weak, blind, or unwise. Our strength must not make us hard and furious. Our principles must not make us fanatical nor sentimental. Let us think calmly, patiently, impartially. Let us love wholly and intensely, but wisely. Let us act with strength, nobility, and force. If even then we make mistakes, yet God makes none. We decide and act. He determines the fruit, and whatever he determines is good. And this is a good stopping place for today. The second portion will be next week. Thank you for listening. Please come again. Tune in next week. Bye.
நீங்கள் கேட்டுக்கொண்டிருப்பது ஆரோவில் ரேடியோ.